afternoon. It's 3:30, and this is the Senate Education Committee. Present today on my left would be Senator Gardner, Senator Huggins, to my right, Senator Giesel, and Senator Stevens, and I'm Senator Dunleavy. Today is February 3rd, 2015. Today we're going to have a presentation from the State Board of Education and Early Development by Esther Cox, Chair, with assistance from the Commissioner, is Deputy Commissioner, Commissioner Hanley, and Deputy Commissioner Les Morris. So with that, if we can have Chair Esther Cox come to the table to testify, if you could state your name for the record. And again, this is a hearing. This is a report to the legislature that's done annually by the school board in an effort to update the legislature, at least the committee in the Senate, as to what's been going on in education from their perspective the past year. So with that, Esther, if you can identify yourself for the record, and you can begin your testimony. And you may want to pull that mic close to you. Thank you.
There seems to be an overabundance of mics here.
We want to make sure we catch every word you say.
There's a mic behind you, too.
There is that.
Silly.
Good afternoon to all of the senators, and congratulations, Senator Dunleavy, on becoming chair of our favorite committee, the Education Committee. I always look forward to a conversation with the legislature regarding my second favorite subject. My first favorite subject is my grandchildren, and I'd be happy to entertain any questions about them at the end. I am Esther Cox, Chair of the State Board of Education and Early Development, and I'm here to implement SB1, passed several years ago, that said the Chair of the State Board will give a report to the legislature within the first 30 days of meeting the legislature. And every governor, every legislature, every educational practitioner wants to see fewer regulations on the books. However, when a bill like the Educational Opportunity Act, or HB 278, is passed, a plethora of regulations bite the dust to be replaced by a multitude of new regs. And additionally, for every educational law passed, implementation regulations must be passed. That's pretty much what I'm here to talk about. Some may be a repeat from your conversation with Commissioner Hanley that you had on Thursday. And by the way, I did tune into that. It's just that I told the bridge operator that I didn't want to testify. So when you said, are there any other board members online, I'm saying, yes, I'm here. But I was on mute. Okay. You have a full report in front of you. It looks like this. And 1 year, we read it together, which was really pretty dastardly, and we all fell asleep. So this time you have a sheet, and we're just going to follow the yellow brick road right down. There are some bullets there, and that's just exactly what I will be talking from. And
so
I'll take you through.
Esther, roughly how long do you think it'll take you? Only because that way we can come back and ask questions off the actual documents itself.
Okay. I think 20, 25 minutes?
Yes. Okay, thank you.
Is that good?
Yeah,
okay.
That's great.
All right. You will hear me mention several things that I indicated before that the commissioner has already told you. But when he talked to you, actually the school board came off sounding pretty good, I thought. But more important, the fact that we were doing some forward thinking. Taking example is the variable term residential programs. Terra Nova's out. And trying, frankly, to stay a step ahead of the U.S. DOE. Okay? So the first place we're going to start is right up here with the little red schoolhouse, HB 278. You'll find a lot of information on page 2 in the report on that, but I'm just going to go through fairly quickly some of the things that have changed, and of course this all involved regulation change. And just to remind you, it isn't that the school board simply passes a regulation. Every regulation has to go out for public comment, and then very often may be changed due to the public comment that comes in, and then we take action on it. Okay? So, first thing that HB 278 did is it repealed HSGQE, which, of course, was the exit exam. And notification has gone out to all those youngsters who received a certificate of attendance and now they can get their high school diploma. The second thing it did was it eliminated the mandate for all 11th graders to take work keys and have replaced it with the students have an assessment choice. They may take the SAT, ACT, or work keys, one of which will be paid for by the state. You know, and I was in educational practitioner for a lot of years, and I see this as a really good thing because I think we'll get much better turnout for the tests, the ACTs and the SAT, than we've ever had because they're expensive. So another thing that 278 did, teachers' exception for jury duty. So if teachers are in a one- or two-star school, that's our rating, and I'll talk a little bit more about the rating system pretty soon, and these schools have the neediest students, and they have an exemption from jury duty that is deferred during the school year, at least. A great thing that came out of 278 is students' ability to challenge courses. Many of you probably challenged courses when you were in college, and we finally have given this right to high school youngsters. There has to be a test. Somebody has to write the test. Somebody has to administer, and somebody has to correct it. Basically, it will probably be the teacher, and the district does have the latitude to charge a nominal fee for that to happen for a student to challenge a course. It's up to the district if they give a grade. Some districts want pass-fail. Some districts want to give a grade. The student does get credit, and it does show on the transcript. And the ability for the district to give a grade or not was strictly input from public comment, because at first it said it would be pass or fail. Okay. Residential schools, 278 sets an annual period for residential school application and a flexible count date for variable term residential schools. And you know what that is. That's like NACTEC when students come in, and we want students to be able to count their count when students are involved in the program. Charter schools, 278 speaks to charter schools. Transportation, it does not say that districts must transport all students to their charter school, but it does say that if the bus goes by, the kid can get on the bus and get as close as possible or to a transfer spot where he can be transferred to his charter school. What's really different about what 278 says about charter schools, you are all aware that a local board accepts or rejects the charter. What 278 says, if the local board rejects the charter, they may appeal it to the commissioner. And if the commissioner stands with the local board, then the appeal can go to the State Board of Education. Before, if a local board turned it down, the charter was dead. HB 278 also provides for a couple of STEM grants, and that is the... They're for underserved middle school students. There are two grants. ANSEPT, which you know already, is the Alaska Native Science and Engineering Program. And it's expanding to grades 8 to 12 and a move from 4 to 8 two-week middle school academies and 12 academies in the following 2 years. SERC, which is Southeast Regional Resource Center, has 3 week-long STEM awareness academies, 1 2-week STEM summer camp, after-school STEM clubs, and a technology-based social network for program participants, which I predict will probably be the most popular of all the things it's offered, because, as you know, young people have social networking down to the nth degree. Other regulations that we have talked and implemented, a new state law regarding restraint and seclusion of students, we had that regulation, and then finally, State of Alaska caught up with 47 of 54 districts that already had more than 2 credits of math required, and now we are requiring 3 credits of math. It sends a message about the importance of math, which everybody who's in education understands, and it's more in keeping with the APS, which is the Alaska Performance Scholarship math requirements, which happen to be 4. Okay? So follow the Yellow Brick Road right down to AMP, which is Alaska's Measures of Progress. And you'll find information on page 6. We have two tests, language arts and math, and of course this is a new testing, a whole new set of test questions that are geared to our new standards, the Alaska Academic Standards. The two tests, we will be grading or testing grades 3 to 10, and the schools may break up the test into shorter segments. Before, they're always untimed, but usually it's taken 1 to 2 hours per test, so they're going to have an opportunity to break this down into smaller units. We have moved down from 185 questions to 140, and the 215 AMP, Alaska Measurement, will be a baseline. And when I listened before, you're not interested in hearing this statement. However, I'm going to repeat what the commissioner already told you, and that was we can expect the scores to be lower because our standards are much more rigorous. So, it's a good thing to have a baseline because if there needs to be more curriculum revision because it's the first go-around, then those things can happen once we see what's happening. Test window is from March 31st to May 1st. It is a computer test, and students will have access to practice tests before they go for the real deal, and the school lacks computer capacity. They may use paper and pencil. You know, many of you are familiar with a longtime educator by the name of Madeline Hunter, and she always recommended dip-sticking, which is called dip-sticking, just like with oil. You dip-stick all along. You don't wait till the end and then assess students. You check all the way along the line to see how they're doing. And so this is all optional, but there are short 8 to 10 questions on specific learning goals, and the teacher is able to do actual dip-sticking and seeing how the students are doing and if they're meeting those goals, and finds out at the time instead of at the end of the the course. So that's going to be available. There's rigor. The students are going to be expected to analyze, to multi-step tasks, problem solve, and application. And I have to say that in my experience in the classroom and as a principal, until I got to the King Career Center, application is always the toughest part. Students will learn, they'll drag and drop, highlight, put items in order, plot points on a graph. We're testing for higher order thinking skills. And you say, well, when are the kids going to learn how to do this? Well, they'll have practice tests. And for my money, kids are born with a mouse in their hand these days, so they come with computer skills ready to go. You want to know what's going to happen with the data. The data will be sent to teachers, parents, and districts. No individual scores go to the federal government. We will produce 10 aggregate reports that go to the public, but no individual scores go to other than those schools and those students. And students who qualify, there are accommodations that can be made for them. Okay, how about ASPI? ASPI, coming around the Yellow Brick Road, that is the Alaska Performance Index. It's our new 5-star rating for schools. It's in lieu of AYP. This year, we scored and rated 501 schools. The statistics of how many schools were at each star rating are in your report on page 17. I'm not going to go over those because there's one thing I want you to hear and hear clearly. 93% of Alaska students attend 3-star schools or better. Okay? What are we measuring? We're measuring student progress and achievement in reading, writing, and math, graduation rate, and student performance on college and career assessments, SAT, ACT, and work keys. Now, alternative schools proved to be kind of an enigma when it came to the rating system. By the nature of the beast, alternative schools house youngsters that have not necessarily been successful other places, and the scoring system didn't reflect the growth that they were making. And so the scoring system has been altered to reflect what progress these students are making, and they now get they can score higher on the STAR system, and they're very, very proud of their STAR ratings. Another thing that had to be changed was small schools graduation rate accounting had changed. If you have two kids in a small school that are going to graduate, only one graduates, well, that sounds 50%. That doesn't sound really cool as far as so those kinds of adjustments have been made in the rating system. Reward schools, they must meet specific criteria. All schools can be reward schools. They must have made significant progress in overall and in their subgroups. And they get public recognition, the banner for the school, and that's really kind of fun. The commissioner said that he listened in, and the kids were really, really excited in their school, and it can hang right up there next to the hockey banner. About that.
Essie, can we take a second and see if we may be getting too far or too deep. Does anyone have any questions at this point? Senator Gardner.
Thank you, and thank you very much for your presentation. I noticed that the waivers, and I saw it here. I don't remember if you actually went through it to the requirement that 70% of the funding be used for instruction, and that count went from 5 districts last year to 23 districts this year who requested waivers. Do we know why there was such an increase? It's more than tripled.
Hey, Commissioner, feel free to come up and identify yourself. And
that's on page 5 of the report.
For the record, my name is Mike Hannon, the Commissioner for the Department of Education and Early Development. There are basically two counts during the course of a school year. There's a first count and a second count. Most of our schools come in on the first count, so there's not a tripling. We average in the range of the 20s.
Two times in 1 year.
Oh, right, so yeah. those five are just the ones that thought they were going to make it. Turns out they weren't able to, so we've worked with them, and they've come forward.
Thank you.
Later date.
Thank you very much. And then on the issue of assessments, we have adopted new state standards, the Alaska Academic Standards, and I understand we've contracted out to another firm to work on the assessments for the new standards, and I don't know the timeline for that and where that stands. Thank you.
Yes, through the chair, Senator Gardner, when we needed to develop a new assessment to match up with our new standards, we put out an RFP as per the state protocol, and we had several vendors that submitted proposals to us, and those were reviewed by our procurement team. Interestingly, we had actually Representative Pruitt was one of the members on our procurement team, and AAI, the Achievement and Assessment Institute out of Kansas, was the highest scoring vendor, and we are currently contracting with them to develop our new assessment. So that new assessment will take place this school year, beginning in March and going through May. We have about a 5-week window this year. So that's coming along fine. We now actually have practice tests in place. And some testlets in place, which provide those dipsticks. Those are optional components, but those are those dipsticks that Chair Cox had referenced that teachers can use to see how their kids are doing moving towards the new assessment.
Thank you.
Senator Stevens.
Just a little concern about the higher standards. That's great. I'm pleased we're moving that direction. But the lower scores is going to be a problem. Are we just going to wait for that bond to drop and every parent is going to call you and everybody on the school board and everyone in the department saying, what have you done to my kid? Or is there anything we can do to prepare for that?
Through the chair, Senator Stevens, messaging is going to be a critical part. And we've actually been working on that extensively. We have several documents that have gone out to the public in regards to our new assessment, to our school districts, to our principals, to our superintendents, as to what we can anticipate in this coming year. We're setting a new baseline with higher expectations. It won't reflect our students moving backwards. It will represent a new expectation that's higher than it was before. I honestly, although there won't be a way to measure this because there's not an adequate way to compare our previous assessment to our new one. Our standards are different enough, and our assessment is different enough. It's just not going to be easily compared. But I do anticipate that our students will actually be higher than they were in the past, but have not reached the new bar that we've set, the new expectations for them. So it's a new baseline for us, but it will seem that not as many of our students are proficient. I think one important note is that in the past, we have shown, and there's actually statistics at the back of this report that speak to NAEP scores and how our students have scored on our previous assessments. And we're in the 70s and 80% proficient on our statewide assessments. But when you look at a national test, like the NAEP that's given every other year in fourth and eighth grade, our students aren't nearly as high. So there's a big discrepancy between what we're saying our kids are doing and what a national test says we're doing. We think this is going to be a little bit more in line with that. But messaging, you're right. Messaging is going to be critical for the department, for our school districts, for all of us in these coming months.
Senator Gardner.
Thank you. I have another question, and other members of the committee might have heard this. A school district was in my office earlier this week, I guess it was yesterday, and talking about students who dropped out of high school in anticipation of being unable to pass the high school graduation qualifying exam. And I remember discussion about, during the discussion last session, about what would happen to people who didn't pass it and could they come forward. But this district is also interested in the kids who didn't finish the rest of the requirements. Now those kids understand that they're ineligible for many types of employment and training because they don't have a diploma. Has the board or the department discussed how we might address this problem and maybe help some of these students who were, if you will, victims of the high school graduation exam and helping them get diplomas? We do it for people who are in prison, but we'd like to get them before that.
No, we have not really discussed this. We have talked about the students who finished with a certificate of completion, mm-hmm. but that youngster that quit school has not been a real topic of conversation, but it certainly is one that is worth talking about. I don't know how many of those students that we'd be talking about, but I suppose there are some.
If I might, Mr. Chair, the district that brought this point up was Barrow, and they anticipated about 136 students in their region who might require a few more classes before they could graduate, and they were kind of looking for assistance with being able to have something maybe in the evenings for kids to get the mandatory classes. Or so I guess they might not be kids anymore, young adults. So anyhow.
Senator Gardner, just curiosity, are these individuals that are under the age of 20?
Some of them are, but some may not be.
So after the age
right,
of 20,
so
it's difficult, I think, mm-hmm. As we have laws, that after the age of 20, you cannot enroll them in the school, correct? Unless they're special ed, which goes to 21? 19, 20.
22 for special education students, but Senator Dunleavy, there are no prohibitions about allowing a student to come back and get credit at a school. There's a funding component. We don't recognize them as students any longer once they've reached, gone past that age. But a school surely could if they chose to set up opportunities for students to get those credits.
Thank you.
Questions? I'm going to have a bunch, so I just want to let folks.
Thank you.
Just, can you explain a reward school one more time? A reward school. How do you qualify as a reward school under ASPE?
There it is.
How do you get rewarded?
All right. I don't know this from memory. I can tell you that. And I bet the commissioner could do a whole lot better job than I can on the reward school. But just to start out briefly, a school is highest performing. It's in the highest 10% of all schools in the state of Alaska in the performance index for grade levels. A school that includes grade 12 and that for two most recent years had a graduation cohort of 10 students or more. Students' combined graduation rate over those 2 years at least 85%. and fewer than 10 students, but all but one of those students graduate during those 2 years. So,
where did that criteria come up from? It's a very interesting criteria.
Senator Dunleavy, we wanted to not only recognize schools that needed support, our 1- and 2-star schools, but reward schools and recognize those who were doing very well. And as Chair Cox said, one of those is what we designate as a high-performing school, our top 10% schools. We also recognize high-progress schools, schools that have shown the top 10% in growth. And both of those are considered reward schools. And we simply recognize those schools. We have banners that go to those schools, as Chair Cox mentioned. Typically, schools have assemblies. I've attended a couple of them where they have a big celebration and hang the banner alongside their other sports banners. But so that's the reward component. It includes high performing and high progress.
But where did the criteria come from? Did it come from the state school board? Did it come from the EDE administration? Did it come from? I'm just trying to understand where that criteria came from.
This regulation was adopted by the state board, but developed by the Department of Education.
Okay, so administration developed it, brought it to the school board, and they adopted it.
Put it out for public comment. Yes, and then Chair Cox actually referenced as well, since we put this in place, we recognize a couple things need to be adjusted, and she actually read a couple of those components, that for small schools, the graduation rate of didn't work very well percentage-wise when you got real small schools. So we made some adjustments to that. We made some adjustments to the alternative schools. But, yes, we put that forward, and it's been out for public comment.
So for Chair Cox's information, I've had frequent conversations with the administration on some of these topics. And when I saw the reward school concept here, it reminded me of the conversations that the commission and I have been having, and that is if you have a 4- and 5-star school, one of the ways that they could be rewarded is to leave them alone, if this makes sense. In other words, as we enter into a period of diminishing resources in which you're trying to help the 1- and 2-star schools, which we'll probably talk about in just a moment, if you have 4- and 5-star schools, why not reward them by leaving them alone? In other words, using an equity model approach to education, if you have schools that are performing, that don't need your attention, that don't need your for lack of a term, and inspections, and I'm not trying to say that in a negative way, I'm just merely saying that why use those limited resources? In essence, in some respects, it would be viewed could be viewed as not bothering the schools per se, but there's no point in it since they're 4- and 5-star schools. Why not reward them, let them alone, let them keep doing what they're doing, then use your limited resources to focus on your 1- and 2-star schools. Has that come up in any conversations at the board level?
And basically, when we get to SSOS, which is state-supported, we're talking about 1- and 2-star schools only. I don't know of anything that we do special for 4- or 5-star schools other than leave them alone and hope that there's an incentive for 4 schools to reach for 5-star.
That's not a trick question. I don't know if I have a feeling they're still required to do certain things and file certain paper and file certain reports. And I guess the only question I would have, and the commissioner I've had this conversation, is kids that are doing well, proficient, advanced, proficient, in a climate of diminishing resources, why not leave them alone? And schools that are doing well, it might be an idea to leave them alone. So you can, again, use those resources for your 1- and 2-star schools. But I'm just wondering if there's still schools out there that are rewarded, if they can be rewarded by leaving them alone. I'm not saying that your intervention is bothering per se, but we don't have a lot of resources.
Chair Donnelly, I guess I would need to look at specifics because the level of local autonomy that we have in the state, we don't interject ourselves very often into school districts. So I guess we'd need to look at some particular area. Our regulations are driven by statute, and I'd surely be willing to have a conversation on places where we could do that. I don't know what they are right off the top of my head.
Okay, I can understand that. And one of the things, the conversation that you may want to have with the board is, again, as we go through this period of diminishing resources, are there things that the board can take a look at in terms of regulations or even possibly some laws on the book that you're getting some feedback on that if we were to repeal those laws or you were to take a look at regulations could free up resources for schools that they can reallocate many regulations, or some regulations, I should say, I don't know if it's many, but some regulations, I'm sure, require schools to dedicate a certain amount of manpower to meeting these mandates. If some of those things could be looked at, I think it could spell some relief for the schools and also streamline things just a little more. What they are, not 100% sure at this point. I've asked schools and school districts that come into my office to start to give me a list of what they perceive are things that could be looked at. But it's just a suggestion. And the reward school concept that was on the paper that you cited spurred this line of questioning. Any questions? We're going to have lots. It's just the way it is. But at this point, how did we adopt ASPE? How did that come about?
Well, we had AYP before that. And AYP was punitive. 37 categories. If you missed in one category, they saw that you didn't make AYP, and schools saw themselves as failing schools. And so we really wanted to build a rating system that had an incentive built into it, so you can reach for the stars, literally, and get there. So we asked the USDOE if this would be a permissible way of rating schools, and for some reason they agreed with us, which was nice. And so we went back to the drawing board, really, and then began with the regulations to implement this kind of a rating system. I have felt from the get-go that AYP was almost like a hammer on schools. I've been around long enough. For one thing, 2014, everybody was going to be at 100%. Everybody was going to be 100% proficient. Well, I haven't seen 100% of anything in my day, not even the pizza topping when you take it to the faculty room. Something's wrong. So this way, everybody can be a reward school, but it also builds in some incentive, and it also makes students feel good to know that they're going to a four-star school or a five-star school.
Senator Gardner.
Thank you. So is it fair to say that ASPE is a waiver to AYP under NCLB?
Through the chair. The answer is yes.
Okay.
Not trying to put words, just want to make sure. So it was a result of our relationship with the federal government through the ESCA grant, or No Child Left Behind grant, the waiver. A school that's a one-star school or two-star school, what do you do with them? What's the plan? So you're a parent of a child in a one-star school in a one-school town. Your school's rated one star. If I'm that parent and I say to you, Chair Cox, thank you for rating the school one-star school, what are you going to do about it?
Well, if you take a look here, you see a hand in hand, and boy, the commissioner can give you a lot more detail than I can because he lives with this 24 hours a day. We have coaches. And these coaches are contracted by deed. Tells you about the coaches on page 11, very often former superintendents. And they do monthly five-day visits in a particular school. And then they do distance coaching in between. And their job is to work with the school leader and the community and the staff to create a plan of improvement. And then the coach's job is to work with the school to see that that plan of improvement is carried out. They have to work with the board. They have to work with the staff. They just can't walk in and say, this is what you're going to do. And we have two distinct tiers of schools. They're Title I schools. Tier one is called a priority school. And these are the schools that really need significant program improvement, okay? It can be, there's a lot of things that need to change if student achievement is going to go upward, all right? And the second one is a Tier 2 school. We call those focus schools. And the improvement plan is targeted toward a special need. Might be mathematics, for example. It may be the program. It may be the delivery system. So everything isn't painted with the same brush is what I'm trying to say. So the coaches are people who have probably worked in rural Alaska, and they've been around for a long time. I think most of the coaches have, two decades at least under their belts? And so there are people that understand and work with the districts.
Okay. So if I'm, once again, if I'm in a one-star school, my child is, and I you explain that to me, which I think is, it makes sense. But I say to you, how long is this going to take? Because my child doesn't have more than a year. My child doesn't have 2 years to wait for the school to turn around. So Department of Education, school board, what are some alternatives for my child? They're a one-star school. You rated it. I really don't want my child to be in a one-star school. I want them to go somewhere where it's a four- or five-star school. Are you going to help with that? Or am I on my own?
No, you're not on your own.
Chair Donnelly, I believe the question first needs to go to the local school board and the school leadership. Our goal is to come alongside of them and help them make those improvements. But the fact that either previously USDOE had said, they haven't met adequate yearly progress, or we came in and said that, you're a one-star school, we'll offer some support for your school system. I think ultimately the responsibility for that change falls in our Alaskan system with the local school and the local school district.
But they didn't rate them. You rated them.
And we just simply recognized their performance for that year.
So as of now, okay. We'll talk more about this as time goes on, too. What I'm just saying is it's one thing to rate a school. It's another thing to say, here's how we're going to take care of your child now, and here's what we're going to do to work on this school as we're dealing with making sure your child gets is placed in a school that is going to give them the best opportunity to learn. I don't want to monopolize the conversation. And I want to recognize online is you have a couple lifelines. Sue Hall from Fairbanks, are you online? Sue Hall from Fairbanks, are you online? And then Kathleen Yar from Ketchikan, are you online?
I'm online, and I think Sue was on, she was muted, and now she's unmuted.
Sue, are you there?
I'm here.
Okay.
Can you hear me, Kathleen?
We can hear both Kathleen and Sue Hall, so we just want to recognize you folks and let folks know that you're online.
Thank you.
Any more questions? Because we did stop Esther at the ASP issue, heading over to the SOS on the paper here. Any more questions at this point? We can go back here once we go through the entire presentation. Okay. If it's okay, Esther, if you could keep going. You're doing a great job until we stopped you there and asked you a few questions. SOS.
Well, that's the state support system of support. We just were talking about that. I think that pretty well covered what I have as far as my notes are concerned. And it's page 11 of your report. Can you think of anything else that should be added, Commissioner?
Just, Chair Cox, simply the recognition that at the higher end, we have that high performing and high progress, and at this end, we are working directly with priority and focus schools.
So 1 and 2 star schools. Okay. All right. Down the yellow brick road, if you would, to Acklen, which is, I think, great program. That's the Alaska Learning Network. That's lots of information on page 12 in your report, but it's run by University of Southeast, University of Alaska Southeast right now. We have 54 district partners. The district pays the enrollment fees, and districts grant the credit for these students taking online courses. There's also a list, at least a sampling, of the courses in the report, but the courses run a gamut. The curriculum requirements for APS are there. That's the Alaska Performance Scholarship. AP courses, credit recovery, some dual credit, and dual credit, something very dear to my heart, and CTE courses. So, and as I say, you can see a sampling of what the courses are when you look at the report. Our fall enrollment was 376, so people are taking advantage of this. And it's a lifesaver for small schools. They don't have the curriculum capacity. They can go online and pick up, and we want kids in small schools to be eligible for the APS as much as kids in the urban schools where they have a huge curriculum bank from which to draw. And the distance issues, it cuts down the distance issues that we have. Also, it's great for professional teacher professional development. Again, distance is a big issue. I know superintendents try to bring their teachers in for some professional development, but there's other stuff that can happen online. You wonder about the funding, the course fees and general funds, plus $850,000 from the legislature. Thank you very much.
Okay. Senator Gardner.
Thank you. I've kind of been following Alaska Learning Network. I think it's a wonderful program. It serves kids with all different kinds of needs, all levels of the spectrum. But I am concerned about the cost. It's $850,000 from the state, plus districts and students, however they work that out, contribute. So there are 376 students enrolled. And I'd like to know, is that 376 classes, or is that individual students who may take one or three classes through ACLIN? Is that a head count of all the classes?
Through the chair, Senator Gardner, that's the number of enrollments, and you are correct, a student could enroll in more than one class.
Is it counted one time or three times in this?
If a student enrolled in two classes, that's two different enrollments, so this 367 could represent 320 kids, or, you know, because some kids took more than one class.
Okay, well, if we just take the $850,000 and divide it by the number of students, we're looking at, you know, $2,260 per student, and that's over and above what their costs are in their home schools. So it's actually pretty darn expensive. I'd just like to point that out.
Through the chair, Senator Gardner, that's a good point to note. There are things beyond the teaching of classes and offering of classes that ACLIN does at this point. They also are training AP teachers or teachers to teach AP in their districts back home so that more AP classes can be offered. They are developing courses. I say they, it's really we. What we have now also is they've developed an Alaska Studies class. Alaska Studies is the one named class right now in social studies that is required for graduation. Unfortunately, a lot of our students go outside to get that. They go to BYU and online courses. We've got an Alaska Studies course that a good portion of it is a gaming platform, historically accurate platform that is being piloted this semester. Mm-hmm. So beyond just the courses, we have those other activities that ACLIN is doing. It's probably important to note that, and we're early in this session, but last year the legislature put intent language in place that we should develop a plan for ACLIN to become self-sustaining. So that ACLIN board, that partnership we have with all of our districts, is moving forward with that. We'll be presenting that. I don't anticipate that we'll be putting forward $850,000, but we're looking at efficiencies in the types of courses we offer and the types of services we offer. I don't know that we're going to get to zero,
but
we are working on that.
Thank you. And, Mr. Chair, I'd hate to see it go away because I think it gives students things they otherwise cannot possibly get and serves us well in that regard, but it is a concern that it's so expensive. We could send them to college for less.
And I don't want to throw a blanket on things, but with a $3.85 billion deficit, there's going to be some things that go away. We're in the process of trying to figure out what that is. It's unfortunate, but it's a fact that, again, last April when we were getting ready to exit Juneau, we had a different picture on revenue than we do right now. But anyway, it's your points are well taken. Please continue. Ackland, you were on Ackland.
No, I think I've said everything I need to say about Ackland at this particular point. It's the curriculum access for students that don't have it that makes it so dear, I think. Teacher mentoring, I don't have any bullets on there for you, but it's another program that gets pricey. It began in 2004 and 5. This year we have 36 mentors, and the specific schools and districts are listed for you on page 13. What works about mentoring is it's teachers talking to teachers. And, you know, when I was teaching school, I felt like I was really successful when I could get kids teaching kids. And that really sinks in. If you ever talk to the teacher mentors, they will tell you that it's the greatest professional growth they've ever had. Our teacher retention with mentor teachers, first year mentor teachers, is up from an average of 68% to 79%, and they remain in Alaska. And just to throw out a few statistics, half of the new teachers in the United States quit in the first 5 years. And the Alaska Mentoring Project can brag because after 5 years, 94% of mentored teachers are still in the profession. They gain a greater professional commitment. And the greatest gain is in student achievement. It stands to reason. Teachers are teaching better. So, and I know, I don't know what the fiscal note is on that, but you would know, Commissioner.
I don't have that off the top of my head.
No. Questions on mentoring? Senator Gardner.
Thank you. And I understand there is data about the cost of teacher loss, and when we lose new teachers, not only the cost to people who change careers when they've just invested a whole bunch into it, but to districts to recruit and replace teachers constantly. And it certainly, I think you use the term stands to reason that students do better when the teachers have been well mentored and when the teachers are consistent over several years. But do we have any hard data comparing new teachers maybe who stay but weren't mentored with new teachers who stay and were mentored and how their students do?
Through the chair, Senator Gardner, we do. When we first began the program, we had a lot of teachers that weren't being mentored. And I wish I had the specifics, but when we looked at how they scored on our statewide assessments, students in classes of new teachers scored significantly lower, and that's a percentage I don't have in the top of my head, than their peers in a seasoned teacher's classroom. But when you put a mentor with a new teacher, those students score very, very close to the same as students in a seasoned teacher's classroom. So we saw that significant difference. The University of Alaska has received a grant to do a study in a couple of our larger districts, and they're working on that now. It's a several-year study. It'll be interesting to see. The data's not out yet. But they've actually provided some with mentors, some without, and they'll be coming up with that. Is it a year from now?
A year and a half from
now, that study will be complete.
Thank you.
Questions? Please continue.
Thank you. High notes, Mount Edgecombe High School. You get lots of information on page 15. Many of you already know this, but the Alaska State Board of Education is the Board of Education for Mount Edgecombe High School. Mount Edgecombe also has an advisory board, and we have a member of the state board on it. Kenny Gellhorn from Kotzebue represents our board on the advisory board for state for Mount Edgecombe. It's wildly successful, and it certainly is enlightenment about an encapsulated environment. They're a four-star school. They're doing curriculum review and revision. We had just had a presentation from the math department. The math folks are working with the language arts folks, which in my tenure in education is absolutely wild. I think it's great. At this point in time, we have Mount Edgecombe has 107 villages represented in school, 84% Alaska Native, and 62% girls, because we lack male dormitory space, to be perfectly honest. Their attendance rate is 96%, and their five-year graduation rate is 98.5%. So that's a school to be proud of for the legislature and for the state of Alaska.
Senator Garland and Senator Stevens.
Thank you. The five-year graduation rate, as I recall, Mount Edgecombe does something a little bit different in the fifth year. Those kids often get certificates and CTE of some sort. Is that accurate?
I'm just looking to Deputy Commissioner Morse. I'm not aware. If, with your permission, we'll...
You can all come up and squeeze in and introduce yourself.
Thank you.
I'd have to...
Please introduce.
For the record, my name is Les Morse, Deputy Commissioner, Department of Education, through the Chair, Senator Gardner. I'm not aware of a certificate. We could get that information, but what I do know is they have a partnership with UAS there. The UAS campus for Sitka is right in the midst of our campus. And we do have CTE programming for our students in partnership with the university there. So I know we have a CTE program.
Okay.
But in terms of what certificates are offered, I can't speak to that. But I wanted to make sure you knew that we had this partnership with the university.
Thank you. I think that's what I'm remembering, Mr. Chair. But as I recall, part of the reason they do their numbers in the five-year graduation rate is because a lot of students stay a fifth year, even though they might not need it academically because they're engaged in these other CTE programs.
Sure. Chair, Senator Gardner, we'll look into that and get
thank
that
you.
Information. I think that's be useful for all of us to have.
Thank you. Senator Stevens.
Well, Mount Edgecombe is a very impressive place to visit, and I've been fortunate to see it a couple of times. I was just wondering if how fully engaged it is in terms of will there be any chance of variable term use of that school, of summer programs like the ANSEP program? Is it used year round? There seems to be a good opportunity there to reach more kids. Is that a possibility?
Through the chair, Senator Stevens, it surely seems like it could be a possibility. Changing it to a variable term would surely change the structure of Mount Edgecombe.
No, I didn't mean to change that, but I mean to bring in students when the school is not occupied.
I honestly believe that that's one of the ways we can look not only at Mount Edgecombe but around the state of maximizing resources that are sitting quiet for 2 to 3 months of the school year. I think it's a possibility. We haven't pursued it extensively now, but I think it surely makes sense, especially in regards to areas like CTE and programs like that, to provide greater opportunities for our kids. We need to put some flesh on that idea, and I think it makes sense.
Thank you.
Through the chair, Senator Stevens, if I may.
Sure.
When I first got on the board, Mount Edgecombe did not bring students in January. You know, their fallout, it's not heavy, but there is a fallout rate, as you can well imagine, from the homesickness and what have you. And kids go home for Christmas and they forget to come back to school. And we got that changed. And so they do pick up students in January. It's difficult for those students, however, because of the rigor that we have at Mount Edgecombe, and They have to work pretty hard, and they work very closely with counseling and with those youngsters too, because it is difficult, and of course, you know, being away from home. So, the first semester students have gotten kind of over that, but for January, but we do bring them in January.
So I think we're going to have a report on Edgecombe in the near future. Correct? Have we scheduled, or we haven't scheduled yet? Okay. Cat's out of the bag. So we're going to be looking at having a report on Edgecombe, and it'll be very interesting to at least for myself and I think others, we're trying to understand the relationship between all these parts within public education in the state of Alaska. You're the state school board, but you're not actually the board for EDGECOM, correct?
We are officially the state board. I mean, we're officially the board of education for Mount EDGECOM.
Then what's the other board that is?
It's an advisory board.
Okay. So this is your school, and yep, you set policy for the school. Okay. So when we do the presentation, I'm going to pretend I'm that father again in a one-star school, and I'm going to say to you, state school board, after understanding what the mission is of Mount EDGECOM, what's the chances of my child getting an opportunity to go to Mount EDGECOM from a one-star school? These will be some of the questions that will be asked. You have a school under your tutelage that's a four-star school. I'm in a one-star school that's been rated. I want my child to go to a better-performing school. Am I going to be able to do that and use EDGECOM as the place to go to?
You know, Senator, I don't have an answer for you with that, except we sort of chatted about that today when I was over at the department, and Commissioner and the Deputy and I, and it's going to be something that we talk about, and I asked the Commissioner to be sure and get that on an agenda, because I know that if a student comes from an area that does not have high school, you know, there's no high school there, okay, that section of the, he gets rated higher in that section of the application. The application is by points, and he gets, 10 points or something from the get-go because he comes from a location where he doesn't have access to a high school. You know, I think our board needs to talk about, should that kind of thing be extended to students from one to two-star schools? Because you're saying exactly what all parents think. We want our kids going to schools that the state of Alaska says are really great schools.
You know, and that's why this is going to be a great conversation, because the flip side of that coin is you have 427 students from 107 villages. So, you know, roughly, let's say four kids from a village, could be more. What does that do to their ASPE score if those are high-performing kids and go to EDGECOM? And so these are the conversations I think we need to have. You know, I constantly talk about an equity model in education, and that is those kids that need the most to make them whole, what are we doing for them? And I'm not 100% sure what the I'm not 100% sure what the mission is of EDGECOM. I'm really not, and I'm hoping to learn a lot from the discussions, but if that's one of the schools under the wing of EED, and EED is labeled, I don't want to say labeled in a negative way, it's just we've got an ASPE score system, so we score schools. So you have a one- and two-star school, you know, the thought is, well, why not send them to EDGECOM? Why not give them first dibs to go from a low-performing school and have an opportunity to get a great education if that's what EDGECOM is all about? And then also, what would be interesting is when we look at the ASPE system and we really dig into it, are we encouraging students to leave, or are we allowing them an avenue to leave, which, quite honestly, if you know me, in the last couple of years, I'm not into holding people into a certain place. What does that do to the scores? You know? What does that do to the scores of that school's, the ASPE score of that school that's there? If you're taking let me rephrase that. If four children are leaving that may be high performers to begin with, and then they're going to an environment that encourages even higher performance, I'm a principal, I'm a parent, et cetera, and I'm looking at a one-star school. So these are the things that I think would be very interesting to see why we do what we do. Senator Stevens.
Sir, that's a fascinating discussion, and you really hit on a really interesting issue. My concern would be, what happens to the low-performing school where the best students leave? What happens to the three students that are left? You know, a really outstanding student staying in a small village can raise that whole school. So, I mean, it's a double-edged sword, and could have quite a negative impact on a school.
Right. So it's just very interesting.
Well, be assured, Senator Donlevy, that is going to be a discussion that we have on the board. I hadn't even, you know, I knew about the student without a high school, but I hadn't really given the thought to the one of the two-star schools. And should there be something in the, yeah, the admissions policy.
And I don't want to drone on about this, but this concept of best practices and equity has been going on for probably 30 or 40 years, and probably one of the another example to point to is years and years and years ago, you might have a teacher aide that would be teaching the lowest performing readers, an individual that was not a certified teacher, given the kids that needed the help the most, while a certified teacher was teaching the highest performers. And some would say that's not what public education was supposed to be about. It's supposed to be a flip-flop. You put the energy and you put the resources into those kids that need it the most. And so that's why, again, I think this will be interesting. These discussions can help me understand the whole ASPE concept better. Maybe it'll help us all understand something different and where we may want to go in the future to help these kids. I just ask a lot of questions. I always have. Are there any other questions? Because I want to go back. I've got a couple more.
Senator, may interject.
Sure.
Because we've had this conversation before in anticipation of this conversation this evening, we actually have our superintendent over at Mount Edgecombe looking at these 107 villages and looking specifically at the schools and determining how many 1- and 2-star schools are represented right now, just to give us a baseline of this conversation that we have in the future, so, and that we have with the board. So we have begun looking at that.
Yeah, and I had a cold cocky on this. You and I have been talking about this for at least.
I was prepared.
Yeah, that's, and I
I think it's anticipating it anyway.
My goal is not to gotcha. It's to understand more and more as we go down through this road. Can I go back briefly to page 2 in the detailed handout, please? I'm looking at paragraph 3. Alaska regulations do not require school superintendents to have a superintendent endorsement or their administrator certificate. Can you recall when that rate came into being, roughly? How long has this been going on? This is page 2, third paragraph from the top. It says Alaska regulations do not require school district superintendents to have a superintendent endorsement on their administrative certificate.
That's correct. I'm just not sure when that came into being.
Chair Dunleavy, I believe it's in the 90s, but I can actually check. It's actually part of statute that got put in place, and so we've been dealing with regulations around that. But I think it's at least the mid-90s. It might even be earlier than that.
Okay. Yeah, if you can let us know down the next meeting or so, that'd be great. Yeah, going down to technology. It says a $5 million legislative appropriation to fund the improvement of Internet speed in public schools was granted. Do you have the status of that at this stage of the game? What's the status of that investment? Any idea? Or is that something you can get to us later?
Yes, that goes out by, Chair Dunleavy, that is, by regulation, goes out by the end of this month. So we are more poised. Districts have applied. We've identified which districts will be getting it. More that have applied than we have money for. The goal is to get everybody up to 10 megabits. Remember that originally Senator Olson had, and we had identified that about $7 million was needed to get everybody up to 10. So this $5 million is going to do the best we can. So it'll be happening this month.
And you gave us a report.
Oh, it was. Oh, it is February.
Yeah.
So it just happened then. It was at the end of January. I apologize, we jumped ahead.
If we could just get a report on who won the grant, who's got the grant, and how much, if that's possible.
Through the Chair Dunleavy, the report has been provided to your staff, and we'll make sure that it's complete and you have exactly what you need immediately, because we've pulled that information together.
Thank you. On page 3, restraint and seclusion was part of there was a bill passed last year. I'm getting feedback, and this is also something I'm hoping to look at this year. I'm getting feedback that this is actually a cost item to school districts, the training and so forth. Do we have any idea what? Are you getting similar feedback that this is costing school districts in terms of training their staff and personnel?
Senator Donovan, yes. It requires training to be done, ideally training at every site, and yes.
probably come back to that. I'll probably come back to that later. Again, if you have questions, please let me know. I just got Senator Gardner.
In terms of data to bring back to us at some future point, I'd like to know the completion rate of people enrolled in the ACLIN program. Mm-hmm. Because I think last year we had some testimony that a high proportion of people will enroll in a program but not necessarily finish it.
So you want to know course completion?
Yes.
Let's see here. Senator Huggins.
Yeah, what you're checking your notes up. A couple things for Esther and the commissioner. Number one, I've been hearing the advertisements, I call it homegrown teachers, right, where we're going to up the quantity and up the quality of teachers, and there's going to be higher standards for accession. My question is, what is the role of the school board, the superintendent, and the principals that are sitting out here in the audience to make sure that the techniques and the practices used to do that, in fact, upgrades the teachers or have some expectation of that?
I read the same article you read, Senator, through the chair, Senator Huggins, about is it University Southeast is really putting on the big push. I think that's for native teachers, people from our native community, so they get involved in education. Go ahead.
I mean, if I might, I mean, quite frankly, no matter where, I think we all recognize that the quantity, the quality, and the accession being in the standards to which you assess new teachers is hugely important for us, no matter where they teach. So,
through the chair, Senator Huggins, I wholeheartedly agree, and it is the one place that the State Board of Education overlaps and has oversight into the university, and that is teacher preparation programs. So recently in this report it speaks to, upping the requirements on for test scores on the Praxis, a nationally recognized exam, and meetings that we have had recently, we being the board and the Board of Regents, on just what are we expecting of our teachers to make sure that's the quality part. The quantity part is an ongoing discussion. How do we incentivize our students to move into this profession? We don't have as much concrete evidence around that, but there have been several conversations and collaboration between the board, a subcommittee of the board, and the Board of Regents on making sure that the quality is there.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. The second item is the governor announced that he was cutting the funding of education, the one-time piece. Could you tell us what that amount is, what the expectation of the different sites that we receive in that money, and what you see as our professional, the impact of that cut?
Through the chair, Senator Huggins, when the request came to each of the departments, it was to cut 5-8%. We made those cuts in our agency, but our agency is so small proportionally that what I presented to the governor's office was, here's our cuts. To go farther than this, we have to go into the formula, and he's well aware, but we did have discussions about the cost, if you will, the impact of making those cuts. The amount of the cut was $32 million for this year. I do have a breakdown by what does that mean to each school district. If you're interested, we can surely get that to you. But I think that the impact of that is clear. It's definitely a reduction in funds. In the past, people talked about flat funding, recognizing the formula was flat, but one-time money was added. And if you look at our funding over the course of the years, it inched up. This will turn the other way. The impact is huge. The governor sweated over that. I know that. It'll impact our kids. It'll impact jobs. It'll impact our communities. One thing that is probably worth referencing is that for districts that receive a local contribution as well, it'll impact the amount of the local contribution coming in. As the state contribution declines, so does the local contribution. I couldn't give you, probably superintendents could give you the direct impact of what it means to their districts, but does that answer your question?
It does. I think we have some responsibility to know what the answer to that is. But Mr. Chairman,
yes.
Thank you, Commissioner. Finally, which I think we have great responsibility for, we require a professional development program in the school districts. And I think it's important. I think it's important for us. But in the full circuit of closure with the parents about the professional development programs exist in each school district, how much money we spend on it, what we get for our money. My assumption, we fly a significant number of people up from North 48. That may be the perfect answer, but I think we ought to know what the answer is, and then by and large, are we making a difference? Because, I mean, we know, you know, that there are some school districts that do extraordinarily well with professional development. We know others are probably just kind of throwing their money up in the air because they have a professional development day or day and a half that's laid out. But our responsibility is to make sure, number one, that the kids are getting the best they can from the cadre. And oh, by the way, the other part is the chairman said earlier, in the time of any time we're spending money, it's important, but particularly important when we're spending money that is hard to come by. So bottom line, I would like to see an overview at some point before we get out of here of the professional development programs that exist in some districts. I mean, you can choose your districts, and what we bought for that, and kind of, do we assess that? Does it matter? Should we be assessing it? And so anyway, I belabor that enough. Thank you very much.
Mr. Chair, we will surely get that to you. Statutorily, it states that students, we have 180-day school years with up to 10 of those being professional development days. So basically, we require 170 student days and 10, but there's not much more language around it. So as you stated, it varies wildly as to what those professional development days are. We could surely get you an example of what one district does.
Schools used to have, and maybe they still do, they would have to file their staff development plans with the Department of Education. Is that still something they have to do? They don't have to do that anymore. Okay. Okay, Senator Gardner.
Some of us have been to national conferences and meetings about education, and there's a movement to push for having kindergarten to third grade teachers have some sort of special training focused specifically on teaching reading and strategies for teaching reading. It intrigues me, you know, and I don't know what the cost would be. I haven't seen any hard numbers, but has there been any discussion with the board or the department about doing that, or maybe with the university, if part of your oversight is to work with the university on teacher quality, and maybe from your own experience as teaching, do you see a benefit in having the teachers of our youngest grades have a real expertise in the particular art of teaching reading?
Anybody?
I'll start with this. Bail me out, okay, Commissioner? Senator Gardner, that's where it has to happen. And, you know, we have instituted now a screening for early childhood for K through 3. And that, interestingly enough, is also, we have a new regulation that says that if your school policy, particularly this goes for charter schools, if your school policy is that you don't start teaching kids to read until first grade, you don't start anything in kindergarten, then you can apply to the State Department, or is it to the district, for a waiver from the early screening until they get to be second graders, and then second graders and third graders. So, and that's something that the board looks at with the teacher preparation programs that come before us is, you know, what is the reading and how much reading instruction. We had a wild scene on reading several years ago before Commissioner Hanley, when Roger Sampson was commissioner, and his idea was that they developed a reading program, and every teacher was going to have to take this reading program. It was interesting to me. We had 400 pages of on both sides of testimony on this program, and plus people coming in for hours testifying, you know, why this wasn't going to work or why it would work. And there doesn't seem to be agreement, and the people, the professionals in the reading community themselves, on, you know, just exactly what should happen with the teaching of reading. But at any rate, it is something that the board looks at in teacher preparation programs as you know, how strong is the reading instruction for teachers to learn to teach reading in the lower grades. My big issue has always been, I think we need to have reading instruction throughout, and certainly for secondary teachers in reading in the content areas. So it's something that we look at in all of the programs. Now, the commissioner has, I know, much more to say about that than I.
Through the chair, Senator Gardner, I think philosophically, you'd probably be hard-pressed to find people opposed to our kindergarten through third grade teachers being strong literacy instructors. We do have a literacy screener in place with the assumption that those teachers have the ability to understand and know what has to happen when a screener comes in and says, here's a deficit, and how to address it. We haven't taken the steps as far as implementation of something like that. I think it will take resources.
Well, let's talk about that sometime.
Okay.
Senator Stevens.
Well, I appreciate the discussion on local contribution, and I, something I really hadn't thought about it, but as the state contribution declines, so does the local contribution. Communities that I represent have been very proud of being able to fund to the cap, and that brings up the issue of the Ketchikan lawsuit. Can you sort of bring us up to date on that? And what happens, how much money is contributed to education statewide by local communities? And I assume that if we say to one community, okay, we'll pick up your share, in fact, we have to pick up everyone's share, that has got to be an enormous impact on the budget. Can you just bring us up to date on that? I'm sure you've given this in other, but we have not heard that here in education. Appreciate hearing your comments.
Can I interject something before you go on? I know that there is, this is still ongoing, correct?
Correct.
So I'm assuming you'll be speaking in generalities.
I'll tread lightly.
Just for, yeah, I'm sorry, continue.
Thank you, Chair Dunleavy. That's correct. I mean, it is active litigation. You're probably aware that the state appealed and is working on a stay while we appeal to the Supreme Court. I can't speak, because it's a public document, I can't speak generally to the findings of the judge. The impact, the local contribution this last year was just over $220 million across the state. The judge did not declare that local contributions were unconstitutional, but the method in which we collected those, he determined, was he could determine that as a dedicated fund, which is a violation of the Constitution, that the dedicated funds are not allowed. So what that means, I believe, to us as a state is that, well, let me back up. He also said that the state is not required or obligated to fully fund education, simply meaning that not required to fully replace the local contribution. So he didn't make a suggestions one way or the other, but simply said the way we do it, the accounting methodology, and allowing that local contribution or requiring that local contribution to go directly to a school district is a dedicated fund. So obviously we are standing by for the answer to this appeal, which I anticipate will be a year to 2 years in the Supreme Court. But considerations, I think, that are on the table are, would we as a state simply say okay and replace that? Would we as a state say, well, then we need to change the way we collect local contributions in a way that is deemed constitutional, which may have no fiscal impact? It just changes the way we do our budgets. Again, I'm not suggesting anything one way or the other, but I think that's what will be before the legislature, is to consider our formula, consider our current statutes, and what kind of changes would need to be take place, or do we want to just stand by what we have and figure out how to fund that in a different way? So that's the update that we have. We haven't been approved of our stay yet, so we're looking forward to getting that soon.
Thank you. Any follow-ups?
When would you expect that, say, to take place? When can, are we, there's no timeline on it?
This is where I'm just not sure. What I know, if it's public information, I don't know.
There's a problem for us to...
yeah, there's a request before the judge in Ketchikan, and he's trying to determine when he can get it back to us because of other commitments he has. And so we've asked for an expedited response, and we're not sure if we can get an expedited response. So if not, it could be a ways down the road.
Well, thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I hope we'll be kept abreast of that as things develop so we know what to expect.
Right. Thank you. I've got a couple more questions. Any questions? So if we go to page 9, I'm looking down at the bottom of Alaska Digital Teaching. I mean, there's other things here, too, I could ask, but we don't have time. It's a 3-year, $15 million demonstration project. Would you be able to give us an update on this, where we're at?
I can, Senator Dunleavy, and the first thing I'll say is $5 million. And so I kind of grimaced because I looked at this just before we came over, and I asked the deputy commissioner. I don't think it was 15, so that was a typo.
I think it's $5
million. It's $5 million. And you can actually see the update of that on the next page.
Okay, these three school districts.
Four. Kenai, Copper River, Kodiak, and Ketchikan.
Okay.
And you can see the amounts that they were each granted. The idea was to reach beyond their boundaries and work with other school districts. You can see the people, the other districts that they've partnered with, to provide resources to those kids as well. That doesn't account for the full $5 million. There is a component that is being considered for our Digital Teaching Academy. I imagine that will be a conversation during this legislative session.
Okay.
But that covers over $4 million there, I believe. Maybe not.
So on page 11, you have districts that are designated Tier 1, Tier 2, Tier 3. Are Tier 1 districts, this goes back to an earlier question, are they left alone?
Tier 1?
Yeah.
Tier 1 are the 1 and 2 star schools.
Okay, so it's Tier 3 that would be 4 and 5?
3, 4.
It's kind of, you know, you got to keep on top of this stuff. It's 4, 5, Tier 1, et cetera, et cetera. So, Tier 3, you know, your 4 and 5 star schools, are they left alone?
We continue, Senator Dunn, we continue the way we always have. We provide them, we recognize them as reward schools for, as we mentioned before, but there's nothing additional added to their plates nor taken away.
Nor taken away. Okay.
Mr. Chair.
Yes.
Maybe
Senator.
It's working.
Excuse me?
Maybe it's working.
I think I'm gonna wrap my questions up here. I'm gonna have one more statement before we close. But are there any additional questions or closing statements that anyone would have? Senator Huggins.
Yeah. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Commissioner, I think in the last 3 to 5 years, there was a little row here in Juneau about the proportionality of special needs students that were identified and the funding implications of that. And, you know, the few talks that I was involved in, it said, yep, it's a hub town, and that's a natural phenomena. And Juneau says, well, yeah, but you guys don't know how to score that process, and you're defaming our name. Have we cleared that up?
Through the chair, Senator Huggins, I'm anticipating you're talking about intensive needs students.
Yeah, it's intensive.
Okay, because part of the formula is just the 20% goes for special education students.
Right.
That's the same, not based on the student count.
Mm-hmm.
I believe we've cleared that up. We had a big spike, you're right, a couple years ago. I'm not sure if it was due to some miscommunication on our part or a training that miscommunicated something. I'm not sure. But what we did see was a huge spike in the number of intensive needs students. And you're well aware that the intensive needs students generate about $80,000+ per student. And so we saw that spike. We didn't see an increase in population. So we do audits all the time. We check those, but we felt obligated to look those over. But yes, we only had a couple of cases that the districts challenged right to a court case of a hearing, but most of them we figured out.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you. Senator Stevens.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. The teacher mentoring program is very impressive to go from 68% to 79% retention. That's 11% office. That's tremendous. Can you give me the time frame we're talking about, the last 2 years, the last 5 years, the last year? And also, my question has to do with rural retention. Is this throughout the entire state, or are we just talking about rural areas?
To the chair, Senator Stevens, these are teachers who remained in Alaska. It doesn't mean they didn't leave rural or go to rural, so we don't have that specific data. After we began our mentoring, I'm just looking to see, I don't believe we have a recent date on here, it's because we began to mentor all of our new teachers. So when we first began, we were able to compare, you know, we had kind of a control group with a mentored group. We don't truly have that anymore because we're mentoring all of our teachers. So we could still see how they're doing, and I don't have that. We have the 79%, but I don't know, we don't have that control group anymore. Anchorage, in their study, is deliberately setting up with a control group. They'll have that in their study, but so it doesn't speak to rural or urban, just teachers who stayed in Alaska.
Thank you. So the 68%, when was that, that we had 68% retention?
I'm looking to Deputy Commissioner Morse.
I think it's current.
Well, we said the program started 2004 and 2005.
Through the chair, Senator Stevens, I think we'll verify this, but I believe this is the current data based on research up through last year from the beginning of the program. From its inception.
So the beginning of the program would be the 68%.
That is my understanding, and we'll verify that for the committee.
Thank you.
Any additional questions for members of the committee? I'm going to ask Kathleen Yar, if you're still online with the State Board of Education out of Ketchikan, do you have any closing comments you'd like to make? I never know if they're there.
Hi, I think you did a pretty rigorous examination of what we've been doing, and I appreciate it. Thank you.
Thank you. Sue Hall from Fairbanks with the State Board of Education, do you have a closing comment? Sue Hall, come in. I think she's there.
I'm still here.
We're going to be wrapping up, Sue. Is there anything you'd like to say before we wrap up?
No, I appreciate the committee's time and the opportunity for us to give the report, and thanks to the commissioner and Esther for doing such a great job.
Thank you. Any closing comments?
Senator Donlevy?
Yes.
One more thing that's not on this page.
Sure. Go ahead, Chair Cox.
That I want to say, if I may, thank you.
Sure.
You know, we've talked about articulation K-16 forever, and it just never seems to happen until, now I've been around long enough, I'm on my third commissioner, and this one, Commissioner Hanley, bless his heart, embraced this whole idea, and we are actually meeting our board with the Board of Regents. We have met one time. It's very difficult with busy people to get them together. However, we have another meeting scheduled in June. We're dovetailing our meetings so that we can meet, and they'll go their way, and we will go ours. We do have a subcommittee that three people from each side of the House, and we're talking about things like the definition of CTE and dual credit. There is a very successful program going in the state of Washington, which is called Running Start, and we're looking at that in terms of could the better parts of that be implemented here, and we're also talking about teacher preparation. So that to me is a real high point, and I'm really pleased to be able to tell you that. And then because CTE is so close to my heart, please take a good look at page 12 and see the implementation of a Department of Labor grant that has come to implement the state CTE plan. It, DOE, DOL, and the UAA, or UA, are all partners in the plan. And these grant awardees run from Highland Mountain Correction Facility to Wrangell up to Barrow. So you get a chance to take a look at that. And I didn't talk about student data because there's a whole lot of numbers on those pages, on pages 17 and 18. But so you know that you heard it at least, our four-year graduation rate right now is 71 point something plus percent. Our five-year graduation rate, and that's something that we have to deal with, is a five-year graduation rate, is 76%. And since 2004 and 5, the dropout rate has dropped from 6% to 4%. So something good is happening in public education. And with that, thank you for your time.
Thank you. And I'm going to close up. There's a lot of parts in, to education in the state of Alaska. There's the State Board of Education. There's the administration under the commissioner. There's governor weighs in, Senate weighs in, House weighs in. There are groups associated with education, several groups that weigh in. There's teachers, there's principals, and then there's parents and students. There's a whole number of stakeholders in this process. We're experiencing an unprecedented drop in revenue. It's unprecedented, historically speaking, and some have said that this particular situation we're now, the 80s, doesn't even compare with the 80s, where we're headed. And public education is one of the top four expenditures in the state of Alaska with debt reimbursement and HESS and personnel. But the long and short of it, it's the first constitutionally mandated program in the Constitution. Point I'm trying to make is we'll get through this revenue shortfall. We don't know how long it's going to last. Some of us are hoping it disappears next year, but I think a lot of us are going to be realistic and think that that may not be the case. In order to get through it, though, in order to have a quality program, we're all going to have to work together on this. We're all going to have to start asking the teachers and start asking the principals, what are some things that are happening now at your schools that maybe we've placed on you in better times when we had money to do things? When that money starts to be withdrawn, if this continues, what's the feedback we can get, and what are the feedback loops we can get from the practitioners on the ground that we may be able to take some things off their plate, even if it's temporary? But I think if we do undergo a revenue contraction that affects schools, whether in the short term or the midterm, we're going to have to address the issues of regulations and laws and things that are placed on the backs of teachers. We're going to have to address the grants that we have from the federal government and the mandates that they have placed on us. If not, I'm afraid what will happen is this whole structure, this whole edifice can go into a free fall, and I don't think that would be good for anyone. So I would like that dialogue to start now. I know that you're presenting tonight in House Education, and some of us will be there, because we really want to understand and get a handle on this so that we can help shepherd this crucial state service through these difficult times. And I know in the past that politics have played a role into things that we do in the different bodies and within the legislature, with the governor's office, with EED. But I don't think we can afford to, I don't want to say play politics, because that's not the intent, especially when you're looking at education and kids, but I think we need to pull together more so this year than we've ever pulled together before. And so with that, I'm going to end the meeting unless there's any closing comments or questions, and we will have our next meeting on Thursday, February 3rd. And we're going to have the folks present on the Alaska Navigator Statewide Workforce and Education Related Statistics. And we're going to be taking a look at SCR3, which is a resolution on Alaska School Choice Week. So with that, I want to thank everybody. Board Member Cox, thank you very much for coming here and presenting in front of us.
Thanks for having me.
Thank you. This meeting is adjourned. Mm-hmm.